the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war. And now, Veterans Chronicles.
On July 20th, 1969, 600 million people around the world watched as NASA astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first men to walk on the moon. Though best known for his historic voyage as part of the Apollo 11 mission, Buzz Aldrin was also a 21-year veteran of the United States Air Force. Graduating third in his class at West Point, Aldrin went on to fly F-86 Sabre jets in 66 combat missions in Korea, shooting down two MiG-15s, and was decorated with the Distinguished Flying Cross. Following his deployment to Korea, Aldrin did a tour of duty flying F-100s as a flight commander in Germany. In 1963, he was selected as part of the third group of NASA astronauts, beginning a career that would culminate with his becoming the second man to set foot on the moon. In this episode of Veterans Chronicles, retired Air Force Colonel Buzz Aldrin sits down with guest host Dr. Lewis Sorley to recount his incredible career. Our story begins with Aldrin's remembrance of his childhood in Montclair, New Jersey.
This is Lewis Sorley for Veterans Chronicles. We're talking with Buzz Aldrin, a veteran of the space program, and we're glad to have you with us today, sir. Thanks for coming.
Well, it's a great week, starting with Veterans Day and a number of activities honoring the veterans of different wars. I'm looking forward to a black tie event tonight. And it's just a real wonderful Patriot Recognition Week.
Well, and having you here and people like you is what makes it so much fun for the veterans, too. Of course, you and I are both numbered in that company. Let's start by getting a little of your early background, please. Where were you from? Where were you born? Tell us about your family.
Well, I grew up in Montclair, New Jersey. My father had just a few years earlier gone with into the reserve of the Air Corps and going with Standard Oil New Jersey. Shortly before I was born, with two older sisters, a fraternity brother of his from Clark University, where Dad started out, in Worcester, Massachusetts, where his physics professor was Robert Goddard.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, after Worcester Polytech and starting MIT, he's in the Air Corps at the end of World War One, and his first assignment was in the Philippines as an aide to Billy Mitchell. And that's where he met my mother, the daughter of an Army chaplain. Her name was Marion Moon. So they got married in the Philippines, and then Dad had an assignment as the commandant of the Air Corps Engineering School after finishing his doctoral work at MIT from 1921 to about 25. And so he was there overseeing the education, technical education and aerodynamics, of all the people who were in the air service between World War One and World War Two. Yes. So he really was able to get to know a lot of aviation pioneers. Sure. And so when he left the Air Corps in the reserve and worked for Standard Oil New Jersey, and his fraternity brother said, why don't you move from this apartment in East Orange to Montclair? Well, he cashed in some stock and bought this home. Yes. Well, the timing was rather good. It was about the first week in October 1929.
Oh, boy.
Before the crash. So
yes.
So the timing for him was very good, and the timing for me pretty much throughout my life has been very, very fortunate, growing up in a wonderful suburban town. And I had great teachers and coaches, even during World War II, when top coach went off to serve in the Navy. We still had an undefeated, untied state champ football team, and I was 165-pound center because I missed the junior year deferring to academics instead of football, and the first game I was sorry I had done that. But anyway, when I got back, they had all the running backs and quarterbacks assigned, and so I was a center. And not exactly on the screening list of Red Blake when I went to West Point at 17 and a half years old, a little young, you know, in retrospect. Yeah. We had people who had been in the service that were in their early 20s some of them had been officers and then became plebes at West Point.
I remember that very well. When I was plebe, my cadet company commander was 28 years old. He'd been a first lieutenant. The exec was 27 years old.
Really?
He'd been a lieutenant. And the TAC, who was the captain, was 26.
What class were you?
56.
56.
56.
Yes.
So this was in 52. These guys, you know, they had that service. Now, I want to ask you about West Point because I'm wondering, is that something that had always been in your mind as a goal, or how did that come to be something that you wanted to do?
Well, with the early aviation pioneers associated with the family, I had my first ride in a Lockheed Vega painted like an eagle with Dad at the command when I was age two, from Newark Airport down to Miami, where my aunt was one of the very early stewardesses for Eastern Airlines in 1930 and so, and she married the vice president and general traffic manager, so her career as a stewardess didn't last very long. But I always visited down in Miami and Coral Gables to my uncle, who was in the airline business. But Dad, of course, had the early pioneers, and he knew the people at MIT and the Institute for Aeronautical Sciences before it merged with the American Rocket Society to form what we now know as the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, AIAA, the major professional aerospace society.
Yes. Had you been to West Point as a youngster to see it and get the flavor of it?
I had never been there. My older sister dated the first captain and another person from Montclair. Yeah. Now, my father, for some reason, had an idea that the Naval Academy would be a better place to go. Yeah. There appears to me, reflecting back the differences between the culture created by the Naval Academy and West Point, make me, again, proud to have had the motto of duty, honor, country, because at West Point, you learn how to lead a platoon, a company, and so forth. Your advancement is dependent upon your demonstrated ability to lead those underneath you. Now, the ensign and so forth from the Naval Academy has a bosun's mate or someone else to take care of the sailors, and his responsibility is networking up the line. And because of that networking resulting in very successful Naval Academy businessmen, my father also noted that in the Pacific War, when they'd move into a new island, the Navy would immediately build the officers' club. Then they'd start dredging the harbor, and they'd run out of money, and they'd get more money to finish dredging.
Because you have to have a harbor.
Well, yeah, but you have to have an officer's club first. See, now the Army would move in there, and they had to plow up the runways and place pierced steel planking down so they could land. And when they got through doing that, they'd build the officer's club, run out of money, so then they'd end up in tents. So that was the difference of how...
of the cultures. And I have to tell you in the course of this conversation that my great-uncle had Army Balloon Pilot's License Number 3. And our family were very proud of that. Tell us a little about your years at West Point, the friends you made, the things you liked about it, things maybe you didn't.
Well, of course, being rather young relative to the others and having such an outstanding high school education in the way of mathematics and calculus professors, the system of grading was just a natural for me. I would study, do what I could incrementally and get a good grade, and I would plot how I was doing. It just allowed me to really appraise my progress and maneuver in a way, judging my emphasis on different subjects, to end up first in the class in academics after my first year. And, of course, being a pole vaulter in high school and a pole vaulter at West Point is a pretty good physical specimen. So I did pretty well as a young towhead in a middle-sized company where we arranged companies by height back in those days. They don't do that anymore. But I think the system, and I just blended into it. I did find that in my first couple of years that I would want to selectively be available to coach other people in my class in academics, yeah, people who are on the football team, and to not be a part of the formal academic coaching for the football team. In my second class year, I discovered a person looking at the board that I was writing on and reported him. Nothing came of that, but the same individual later, there was distinct evidence that he had a paper from an earlier exam that he was copying during a second period. And the honor rep looked at it, saw it, but didn't take it for evidence. So unanimously guilty. The commandant, I guess, had some pressures from whether lawyers or other people and decided not to silence the cadet found guilty by all 24 companies. That made it a little difficult. Now, it turned out that after we graduated in 1951, the fall of 51 was when the cheating schedule broke out, and the coach's son and 72 other people were resigned from the academy because of the cheating. And clearly, the coaching, academic coaching of the football team, which this person that I had discovered, it took me a good while to sort of get over that people would do it. And my first class year, he was a company commander, and I was his exec officer. I was third in the class, and I think he was fourth or fifth on graduation. But I've just had to say that those sort of things do happen. And fortunately, many, many years later, another classmate of mine is having a very thorough investigation of the honor system at all the academies and the sexual abuse that has arisen at some of the academies. So I think it just takes a period of time, and we'll probably work our way through a lot of these idealistic failures of the system. Yes. Though I would have to say, if the country is suffering from anything in these past 10, 20 years, it's a growing loss of integrity and an increasing sense of what's in it for me right now. Short-term objectives of people and service of the country is not high on people's list.
And I think what you've just described to us shows you that none of these things are fixed forever. You have to keep coming back to them. You have to keep correcting them over and over again.
When Veterans Chronicles returns, Colonel Aldrin recalls his early days in the Air Force and his experience as a young fighter pilot during the Korean War. Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. Our story continues as Buzz Aldrin, freshly graduated from the West Point Military Academy, enters the United States Air Force.
At the time you graduate from the military academy, of course, there's no Air Force Academy yet. Mm-hmm. And so, as you'll recall, that both Annapolis and West Point are putting 25% of each class in the Air Force.
Sure.
And given the background you've described, I'm assuming that you had your eye on that from the start.
Well, the Naval Academy, it's a, sort of a random selection. People don't always get their choice. It's a random lottery-type selection, but at West Point, it's by your standing, class standing, in not just academics but everything else. It gives you a class standing and your ability to choose what your branch would like to be. I would like to make one observation that standing fairly high in social studies, after my junior year, a number of us firsties that were sent, 10 or 12 of us, sent to the Far East for a tour of MacArthur's occupation of Japan and other things. And the night we got there, we stayed in the BOQ. The next morning, the Stars and Stripes underneath the door said, North Korea invades South Korea. So I got over there at just the time that the Korean War started. So our trip was cut short, went back and finished my first class year, got in the Air Force. And at the end of 1 year, I was a fighter pilot, went through gunnery school. And then for the whole year of 53, I was in Korea during that year. And it was about 6 months of the Korean War.
And you had a large number of combat missions, did you not?
66 missions. It was about average. We arrived over there in January, and the squadron that I was in was having quite a bit of good success shooting down MiGs. And then one day, the squadron commander was shot down north of the Yalu River. And in the investigation, one West Pointer who was on his second tour told the truth that they were flying north of the river. And this West Pointer, his military career essentially was terminated because he told the truth. Now, that kind of rubbed me a bit the wrong way. It wasn't his choice, but there were a lot of people who did destroy enemy aircraft north of the river. And we know that.
Yes. And you yourself had some kills, did you not?
Yeah, one of them was a guy on a training mission, I'm sure, down low altitude, about 20, 30 miles south of the river, and he just did nothing except a gradual turn till he fired off the canopy and bailed out. It was pictured a week in Life magazine, so that became my first second lieutenant exposure to a bit of celebrity status.
Not bad.
Now the next kill was following a... I joined up at a flight in front of me because they had number four man abort and my wingman aborted, so I joined up as number four man. I didn't know who it was, and then I realized that they had F models and I had an E model, kind of hard to catch up. The bombing mission was right at the dam of the Yalu River, so we knew it was going to be a hot mission and the MiGs would be up. So still trying to catch up with this flight, made one circle over the target, and they immediately headed north of the river toward the base near Mukden, Manchuria. And when we got there, I'm still trying to catch up. So they dive on in, and I'm still trying to catch up to number three man, and pretty soon a MiG slides in front of me, and we hassled, and I shot him down and headed back south again. That was a little bit more exciting.
Yeah, that sounds pretty hairy.
Yeah.
This is great. When you came home after that tour, what happened to you next? Let's cover the period between then and the astronaut program.
Sure. Well, from Korea, I instructed gunnery until going to the squadron officer school and on my way to an assignment at the Air Force Academy in 55 as aide to the dean of faculty. I was there a year. He was moved out. I instructed the second lieutenant's upperclassmen in flight training for a while. And then I had my choice of assignments, supersonic F-100s in Bitburg, Germany. I got over there, and Ed White, who I'd known as on the track team at West Point, says, you got to get into this great squadron, the 22nd Squadron. So I did, and he and I represented the squadron in NATO gunnery exercises. Then he shipped back about a year and a half, 2 years before I did. That's about time when we transitioned from escorting along the border to nuclear weapon delivery. I helped to organize an alert squadron approach to handling alert with nuclear weapons. But Ed went back to Michigan 2 years and test pilot school, and then he got into the astronaut program. As this was playing out, I went to MIT and decided to go for a doctor's degree. So I did that and made the wisest choice, I guess, of my career in taking what I knew in intercepting airplanes and what MIT had and writing my thesis on rendezvous in space. And then the president says we're going to go to the moon, and a year later I'm still working on it, and they decide that the way they're going to go to the moon is lunar orbit rendezvous. So now what I'm studying is rather in demand, but I'm not trained as a test pilot. So my application in 62 is turned down. Ed is selected, but they changed the rules, and I joined the third group of astronauts and I started training in 64. Finally, I got a chance to fly on the last Gemini mission, and that was only because of a tragic accident that advanced my position in the pecking order. It wasn't very promising for a while, but being in the right place there put me in an enviable position with the Apollo mission starting assignments after the Apollo fire juggled things up and the lunar module wasn't ready. Next thing I know, Neil and I are backing up the second Apollo flight, and it's going to go to the moon and orbit the moon. Well, it's a wonderful mission to be on the backup crew for. And being on Apollo 8, they had crews to 9 and 10, so we were then assigned the prime crew on Apollo 11. And with the success of the lunar module test in Earth orbit, then a dress rehearsal with the lunar module in lunar orbit, we were given the clearance to go ahead and do the best we could to make a landing. And we did, despite computer alarms and 15 seconds of fuel left, we got on the ground.
Buzz Aldrin shares the effects of the lunar landing in his personal life when Veterans Chronicles returns. Upon his return from the moon, Buzz Aldrin had become an instant celebrity. The return home took its toll on his personal life, however, seeing him descend into what would become a very public battle with depression and alcoholism. As the story concludes, Buzz Aldrin recalls his father's reaction to his legendary voyage.
I have to say, so many parallels here, including the doctorate, that yep. your father must have been, did he live to see all this?
Yes, he did. My mother took her life a year before I went to the moon. And that somewhat began to preview the next parts of my life. All three of us on Apollo 11 elected not to fly again and take a good mission away from other people. So I stayed around till my kids were out of school. And then despite not being trained as a test pilot, the Air Force decided they had somebody else for commandant of cadets at the Air Force Academy. So they asked me to be commandant of the test pilot school. Well, I went ahead and accepted that.
Where was that?
That was at Edwards.
Yes.
In 1971. So after a year there and seeing that that really wasn't taking me where I wanted to go in the Air Force, I retired. And with that somewhat unsuccessful reentry into the service and not knowing what I do next, the depressive tendencies that I inherited began to put me into not very good shape, and I began consulting people. I wrote a book about depression, my depression, entitled Return to Earth, because that was more important than Journey to the Moon, to me, more challenging. Yeah. So pretty soon, I'm a national chairman for mental health, not exactly what a West Point fighter pilot really set out to do.
But a very courageous thing to do.
But then I had to deal with alcoholism addiction, which came fairly naturally, I think, with depression and not having a structured life. That's damage for anybody who is a hard-driving person and then all of a sudden doesn't have the compelling structure of what to do next.
Yes.
Fortunately, I was able to, not immediately. It was a very difficult transition. But I now have 31 years of sobriety and just a growing clarity of being able to look and analyze what I ought to be doing, what I still know how to do, which is spacecraft of the future and how to plan what that can happen. And then after about 10 years of sobriety, I meet a lovely lady and decide that bachelorhood is just not the way I ought to continue life. So we get married and live in Laguna Beach, and I begin to get things back together again, learn about how to have orbits that cycle back and forth between Earth and Mars, and really am getting back into the future, the post-shuttle period.
Is this when you start writing these very interesting books? Is that part of that same period?
Well, yes. I had really started thinking about what do I know that people would ought to know. They know how to get to the moon. We think we know how to get to Mars. Yeah. But people generally don't know anything about the energy it takes to go from one star to another. So I wrote a story about interstellar travel, science fiction story. Yeah. And still hoping to get that into a movie. It's one of the more fantastic things that I think I've participated in. And then I wrote a documentary, Men from Earth, another science fiction story. Yeah. Then I wrote a children's book, and then the second children's book, and now I have a second autobiography out, Magnificent Desolation. The last two books were sort of timed as we approached the 40th anniversary of our lunar landing.
And he just very kindly signed Magnificent Desolation for my wife, who bought it up at Carlisle Barracks. It's interesting to me. I don't know that too many people can write in as many different genres as you. You've written autobiography, you've written space fiction, science fiction, and you've written children's books. Now, I think that's
well,
quite impressive.
It all comes from taking advantage of what's available. I wanted to write a science fiction story, and Tom Clancy said, no, I got too many things going on. So I ended up writing a documentary of Men from Earth. Then I finally got around to the science fiction story, teamed with a very good writer. I've always realized my shortcomings, and it's not desiring to sit down and write things out. But I talk a pretty good game.
You can tell it, yes.
I've gotten better and better. I used to hate ever giving speeches, especially if they weren't from notes or very regulated. And, yes. And now I can begin to talk about almost any subject based on the sincerity and purity of my knowledge.
And I've also seen a very good video documentary that I believe your wife has produced with your collaboration. Have I got that right?
Well, we have an introduction to speeches that we do, and it's a very good introduction as the years go by to what exactly did happen 40 years ago.
It's very dramatic, and it's very well done.
But there are documentaries that have come out, and I participated in those. In the Shadow of the Moon, I had quite a few of us who'd been to the moon, and seven of the living nine people who walked on the moon were involved in the wonder of it all. And those are documentaries of the people telling their stories. Whenever fiction comes in, whether it's an Apollo 13 movie or a Moonshot or whatever it is, the drama of Hollywood or wherever they produce them begins to come in and show and emphasize things that they want the public to remember instead of what really happened.
Well, and I think the fact is there's been no more dramatic story in our lifetimes than the factual story that you've been a part of.
Well, yes, Apollo 13 was a wonderful story in writing, and then the movie, everybody knew the answer, but there was that certain amount of suspense, even though they knew how it would work out, and that was played up very nicely by Tom Hanks and Ron Howard. But I really do think that as things have evolved, I've been very fortunate to be a part of a very remarkable series of changes and ups and downs in the career that has been very fortunately rewarded in many ways. And it had its magnificent apex landing on the moon. And then I had my desolation period and trying to recover. And I'm moving back up into what I feel are just priceless opportunities to try and make a difference in the future of our nation and the future of the world in the field of human space exploration. I really think that we can have human beings from the planet Earth settling on another planet, Mars, within 25 years.
And that's a great new crusade for you to be embarked upon.
Not if we go back to the moon again. Let's let the Chinese and the Indians and the rest of them go there with our help. We'll help them all we can.
I want to thank you, sir, for a great conversation. We've been talking with Buzz Aldrin, graduate of the United States Military Academy, a hero of our space program, a renowned author, and a very nice man. Congratulations, and thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
This is Louis Sorley for Veterans Chronicles.
Welcome to World War II Chronicles, a weekly tribute to America's fighting men and women in commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the Second World War. These programs are narrated by Ed Herlihy and are based on the news broadcasts of the war period from the recorded sound collection of the National Archives in Washington, D.C.
Japanese flash. Imperial headquarters announces state of war with the United States. We'll repeat that again. A Japanese flash. Imperial headquarters announces state of war with the United States.
Mayhem struck the Hawaiian island of Oahu for 2 hours that morning. So dense were the explosions that the sky became almost black as night. The USS Arizona and Oklahoma were sunk. Six other battleships were severely disabled. Almost 2,500 Americans died in the attack, and more than 1,000 were wounded.
Members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
The greatest single effect of the attack on Pearl Harbor was the almost total polarization of world opinion. Nation after nation fell into place on one side or the other. By Christmas, 38 nations representing half the population of the world were at war. I'm Ed Herlihy. Join me next time for World War II Chronicles.
World War II Chronicles was produced by the World War II Veterans Committee and Radio America in cooperation with the National Archives. The World War II Veterans Committee is collecting oral histories in commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the Second World War. For information, call the World War II Veterans Committee Veterans Hotline at 1-800-704-2484.
Welcome to Heroes of the Air, true stories of those who flew for America and earned the nation's supreme military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Heroes of the Air is brought to you by the Air Force Association, an independent nonprofit aerospace organization which promotes public understanding of the role aerospace power plays in our national defense. Your host for Heroes of the Air is Gene Pell. Edward Vernon Rickenbacker was truly a remarkable man. A hero of war, an eminently successful businessman, an able diplomat, a generous philanthropist, and many other things in his decades of service to the United States and the world. He was, perhaps above all, a warrior, one who cheated death several times over, including one remarkable survival after 24 days on a raft in the Pacific Ocean. Captain Eddie, as he was affectionately known to tens of millions, was also the recipient of the nation's highest award for valor. Eddie Rickenbacker was one of the top race car drivers in America when World War I began. He wasted no time in signing up, soon found himself in France on the staff of General John Pershing, and then managed to get himself assigned to the Air Service. He had found his real love. He quickly proved his skills in the air were as great as they had been racing cars on the ground. And well before the autumn of 1918, he was designated America's Ace of Aces for the number of enemy planes he had downed. On September 24th, Rickenbacker was named commanding officer of the famed Hat of the Ring Squadron, the 94th. And early the next morning, he decided to celebrate by undertaking a one-man mission over German lines. As he wrote in his autobiography, "Over Verdun, I spotted them coming. Two LVG two-seater photographic planes escorted by five Fokkers flying protection. All seven went by underneath me, and I cut back the engine and dived on the last Fokker." That was his first victory of the morning. Before the engagement ended, Rickenbacker had brought down one of the two-seater aircraft as well, adding to a total of what would eventually reach 26 confirmed victories in the air over France during the war. But it was for that specific action on September 25th, 1918, that Rickenbacker received the Congressional Medal of Honor for his conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty. After the war, Rickenbacker founded his own automobile company, but could not escape the lure of flight, becoming one of the most prominent and effective executives in the aviation industry. Eddie Rickenbacker, truly a legend in his own time and an American hero of the air. The Air Force Association is proud to bring you Heroes of the Air, dedicated to those who earned the nation's highest military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Their service and sacrifice reflect an ideal that puts others and country above self. AFA salutes all men and women in the Air Force who so selflessly serve our country each day at home and around the globe. Heroes of the Air is produced by Pelcom Communications in association with Radio America.
Welcome to Profiles in Valor, stories of decorated men and women serving in today's military. And now from the American Veterans Center, Tim Holbert.
Our guest this week is Colonel Michael Mann, United States Army Reserves and recipient of the Bronze Star for service in Afghanistan. Colonel Mann, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Army reservists are often referred to as our country's real citizen soldiers. Tell us a little bit about your life outside the Army and what led you to join the Reserves.
My civilian job is an economist for the Department of Commerce, the federal government. What led me to join the Reserves was my love of our country. When I was younger, I read history, and it helped me understand that we should not take our freedom and prosperity for granted. So I wanted to serve and help protect our country. And I was inspired by my father, who served in the military as well.
And how long have you been a member of the Army Reserves?
Been a member of the Army Reserves 28 years, and I also served 2 years in a ROTC program in college to get my commission, so I've been wearing a uniform for 30 years now.
Did you have any idea it would be such a long and fulfilling career?
It's been everything I expected and more. I was always a big fan of the military, and it's been a great experience, and I'm going to be sad when I have to take off this uniform in a couple years. I'm going to be required to retire when I have 30 years in service.
In 2009, you were set to deploy to Kuwait and then received a last-minute change of mission. Tell us about this new mission you were ordered to take on.
Yeah, that's right. We had been training up for several weeks, really months, to go to Kuwait to support the actions in Iraq. Then about 30 days before we were set to ship out, we got word that we're heading to Afghanistan, which is a considerably different theater of operations and poses different challenges. That got us quite excited but pleased. That was considered by us, and I'm sure this is true, it was a bigger challenge. Logistics infrastructure, which is our job, was pretty well established in Kuwait and Afghanistan, and it was just emerging at a much grander level in Afghanistan. We thrive on the idea of the challenge.
Well, you served as deputy commander of the Expeditionary Sustainment Command. Tell us a little bit of what goes into this job. I'm going to imagine that your background as an economist really comes in handy.
I think my economics background helps in the military, and my military training has served me well as an economist, and you get a lot of leadership and management experience in the military. Our job was to provide logistics support to all U.S. personnel throughout Afghanistan. So last year there were 45,000 or so U.S. personnel, and increased to 68,000 over the course of the year. And our job was to provide them with all the supplies and services they needed to survive, everything from food, fuel, ammunition, maintenance to their vehicles, human resources. Thanks to the terrific logistics soldiers, we succeeded.
Well, what are some of the challenges that go into preparing for such a rapid increase in the number of U.S. service members that are deployed into theater like Afghanistan? As you said, you had a massive increase in the numbers in a short period of time. And what are some of these challenges that you face?
Getting the personnel there is not the big challenge, but getting all their equipment there is a bigger challenge. There's limited airports and air assets to move equipment by air. It's also difficult to get equipment into Afghanistan by ground. We have to move it mostly through Pakistan, although some comes through the stands, the countries up north. So there's a small straw to move large volume of equipment. We also need a place to house all those soldiers and their equipment. So we were deeply involved with building FOBs, what are more commonly known as forward operating bases. These are camps spread throughout Afghanistan. We're building camps in the middle of the desert.
Now, the narrative to your award cites your outstanding leadership in achieving the goals that were set for the men and women under your command. From your perspective, what goes into being a great and effective leader?
Well, it's certainly caring about your soldiers and their welfare. It's about having a lot of stamina, recognizing that mission always comes first, but at the same time, you have to take great pride and care, as I said, in your soldiers. Also, setting the example. Don't expect anything of your soldiers that you're not willing to do yourself.
Colonel Michael Mann, thank you for your service.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your audience.
Profiles in Valor is produced by the American Veterans Center and Radio America. To hear more profiles, subscribe on iTunes or visit www.americanveteranscenter.org.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center in association with Pelcom Communications.